Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello and welcome to the Write Club podcast, where we take you behind the pages and into the fascinating world of writing. I'm Mary and this is Beth, and we're part of the team at Writing Magazine and Writers Online. Hi Beth, how are you?
Hi, yeah, I'm really well, thank you. We're just going to get straight on to introducing our brilliant guests this week. Got Daria Lavelle, who writes fiction, most of which features some pretty impossible things. Born in Ukraine and raised in New York, her work explores themes of identity and belonging through magic and the uncanny. Her debut novel, Aftertaste, is a dark comedy about food, ghosts, and the New York culinary scene, which came out in May 2025. Her short fiction has appeared in Dark Matter, Deadlands, Dread Machine, and more. And her work has been shortlisted for prizes by the Masters Review and the Molotov Cocktail Zine. She holds a degree in comparative literature and creative writing from Princeton University and an MFA in writing from the Sarah Lawrence College with a focus on speculative fiction. Daria, welcome to the Write Club podcast. Where are you joining us from today?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here to chat with you. I am joining you from very rainy northern New Jersey in the United States. And I'm happening to be in the office that my husband and I share.
Is that where you do most of your writing?
So no, I tend to do most of my writing at cafes and libraries. I think that the ambient noise kind of helps me zone in and focus and helps me think about what I want to write next. There's something about getting energy from people while I'm working that's always really helpful to my process.
We featured you in our July Path to Publication feature in Writing Magazine, where you describe with real wit and humility how you decided at the age of 15 that you were going to be a writer, and 20 years later, here you are. Why did you want to write, and how can you, and can you tell us what gave you the determination to stick to your dream?
Sure. So, I was very fortunate to grow up at a time when, especially kind of being a middle grader, young adult into a teenager, those were the stories that were in the cultural zeitgeist at the time. It was a time, this is like the early aughts, when books were experiencing, you know, midnight release parties and being made into movies. And there were sort of those water cooler books that especially people my age, like everybody was reading, you know, Hunger Games at the time. There was always like a book that everyone was experiencing together. And growing up and seeing that around me and seeing people get excited about stories and storytelling really sparked something in me. And then of course there was Christopher Paolini with the Aragon series. You know, he was my age at the time and he had published this big book. And so I had this idea in my head of, you know, maybe I could do that. I had always loved reading and writing. And I was always a kid who told stories and made things up and invented. Fairy tales and mythologies were always such a core part of who I was. And they kind of made up my view of reality in a lot of ways. So I decided that was something that I was going to pursue. And I thought that I could, you know, really make that dream happen. And like, you know, from the article, it took many, many years. It took many, many tries. I did not publish at 15 like Christopher Paolini, but I did learn a lot of lessons with every single book that I worked on, every story I submitted. And I managed to find some success with short stories. So I submitted short stories to competitions and contests and, you know, I would win things or I would get something published in a little magazine. It was hugely encouraging, especially at that age. And I also had some really incredible teachers who were really encouraging, who'd read my work, who, you know, submitted a play that I wrote for a festival and it got produced, which was really exciting. So I had these moments where I was encouraged along the way and I felt like what I was saying was important. It was resonating with people. And as I got older and went through university and wrote more long form and tried to get published traditionally with a novel, I had all of those same setbacks that so many writers experience. I think most writers that I talk to about their first novel will be like, oh yeah, it's my first published novel, but I have seven in a drawer somewhere that will never see the light of day. I think that's a really common experience because I think, you're working simultaneously on your craft and on the business of writing, and things just have to kind of line up sometimes the right way. But I think for me, what kept me going through all those years and through many rejections was the fact that I couldn't not write. It was just such a part of me. I was happiest when I was writing. I was happiest when I was storytelling. And from that moment when I was 15 and kind of decided this is what I want to do, in my head, I would narrate the world. So I would move through the world and I would tell it to myself in stories and sentences, and I couldn't stop doing that. So I would constantly be, experiencing something and thinking of it in word form and thinking about how I would put it on a page, and then I would just have to write it out of my system. So I didn't have a choice. I had to be a writer.
Oh well, it's a good job that you kept with it anyway, because Aftertaste is an absolute brilliant, brilliant debut novel.
Thank you.
And what other jobs did you have along the way, and how have those experiences kind of influenced your writing?
So I was thinking through this question, and interestingly, I think the thread through every job I've had is storytelling. So when I was in university, I did a lot of graphic design. So I would design posters for plays that were happening on campus, or, for little ads for student groups. And visual storytelling is very much a part of the design process. And I went to high school that focused on visual design, so that was always very much in my head. And then once I graduated university, I went to work in marketing. And so I worked for a software company, and I was doing the marketing, but I was also designing the user experience of the software itself. So I was, again, more visual storytelling. And then I worked for a branding agency for a while, so in advertising. And one of my favorite things to do there, will not surprise you, was brand voice and naming. So there would literally be times when our clients would come to us and they were developing a new brand, or they were re refreshing an older brand. And they had to figure out how to sound, like how their brand showed up in the marketplace, what a website article from them sounded like, what a press release sounded like, what an ad sounded like. And there's so much care that gets taken to make sure that a voice is perfect for a particular brand. If you're in the healthcare space, how do you show up as caring and professional? If you're in the sneaker space, how do you show up as like cool and exciting? And how does that come through in your voice? And I think doing a lot of that work certainly translated into skills that I use in writing, and vice versa. The skills that I was using to come up with stories definitely translated into my job, especially as far as brand voice went. And then naming was just a really fun thing I got to do on the side, naming brands, naming products. And that, of course, is really helpful for writing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the name Aftertaste is just genius, because I mean, for everybody who has read the book, they'll know that that is completely perfect to everything that kind of goes on throughout the book. So, would you be able to tell us a little bit about Aftertaste?
Yes, of course. So Aftertaste is the story of a man named Constantine. He loses his father at a young age and soon after discovers that he has gained this ability to taste the food of the dead. So he can taste the most significant and important meals in a spirit's life. And as he gets older, he discovers that by actually cooking those dishes, he can bring a ghost back from the afterlife for a last meal with the people they loved. And that sends him on a journey to open a New York City restaurant serving closure. Along the way, he falls in love with somebody with her own secret connection to the afterlife, and he inadvertently causes a lot of problems and consequences for the dead that he's been trying to help.
I absolutely loved it. It's so fresh, and it's funny, and it's dark. It's been described by lots of people as a multi-sensory reading experience. I love that link between senses and memory. How do you use senses, in particular taste, to awaken your creativity?
I love this question. I think usually the traditional adage and wisdom when you're writing is show, don't tell. So I think, we're visual creatures, and for a lot of readers, they can visualize something right in their head. For a lot of writers, they can do that as well. But I think there are so many other interesting moments that you can get almost synesthetically when you're using different senses. And I knew as soon as this was a story about ghosts and food that taste was going to be a huge part of it. I think part of what obsessed me about this idea when it first came into my head was, I'm an ultimate foodie. I've loved food since I was a little kid. I love to cook. I love to eat. I love to experience kind of all of the pleasures of taste. And the idea of being able to communicate character through taste was so appealing to me because I hadn't seen it done, especially done on a level where it's not just one particular scene. Almost every book has some sort of food scene where characters are sharing a meal or like out to a drink or something like that. But what I tried to do in Aftertaste was create this sort of memory Proustian Madeleine experience with every single flavor that Constantine, the main character, tastes. And it's these flavors and the relationships that the spirits and the living experience around these flavors that serve as the tether between them. And so part of what I was doing and thinking a lot about was situating a particular dish that connected two characters, not only based on, they grew up in a certain place and this dish was popular there and so they ate it, but more about this particular flavor profile in this dish is going to evoke this particular memory. So one that I think about a lot and that comes back again and again and again throughout the book are Reese's peanut butter cups. And that was one that I put in so intentionally because it's a mass manufactured product, right? Like anybody can go to the corner store and pick up a Reese's and taste it. But what makes it special for the two characters whom it connects is every moment that it brings back about this particular Halloween they spent together. And so it's not just a Reese's, it's also this feeling of abandonment and betrayal and this bond between sisters that was never supposed to be broken. There's so much more to it. And I think that's what food does. I think you can sit down with someone and ask them, what is a food that brings somebody that you love back to you? And everyone is going to have a different answer to that. And it's going to be so specific. I think there's beauty in that.
What? Sorry, I know, Mary, you're desperate to ask your next question, but I'm just absolutely fascinated. Like the concept of the book is, like Mary said, I've never read anything like it before in my entire life, and it's absolutely brilliant. But where on earth did that idea come from?
So we'll detour quickly. So back when I was working in advertising, I did the very cliche thing that people in advertising or other jobs in New York do. I worked my day job and then I would go to a cafe every day after work and I would write until they kicked me out. And so I was sitting there working, having a little writing session, and I tend to have initial sparks of ideas very visually. I'm a very visual writer. And so I had this entire scene play out in my head. And it was this man in this Hell's Kitchen apartment, and he's plating this dish, and he's being very meticulous about it, although he doesn't seem like someone who cooks all the time. And he's plating this dish, he's wiping the edge, he's setting it on the table. And as soon as that food hits the table, this beautiful glittering ghost comes through the wall and tries to eat this food. And that was like the whole thing, full
Wow.
stop. And so immediately in my head, I had a thousand questions like, who is this guy? Who is the ghost? What's the magic? What does the food have to do with it? Can he do this with anyone? Is there some special thing with them? And in unpacking all of that, this story kind of came to me and grew into the novel that it is now. The first things that I tried to write about it were actually one of the scenes that is in the middle of the book now, where Constantine opens the supper club and he puts this flyer out to invite people. That was the very first scene I wrote. And I wrote it as a short story and I got to what I thought was the end. And I realized very quickly that it wanted to be a novel, that it wanted to be so much bigger than this tiny little scene. And it took me many years to figure out what the relationship was between the ghost and between Constantine, between his food and the magic of summoning people back, between food and memory. But I think in the end, it's the story that I needed to tell and I needed to have the time and space to think about it. And I'm really pleased that it's connected with people.
I'm actually really surprised that you didn't say you'd worked in a kitchen when we asked about other jobs, because I thought you must have worked in a kitchen.
No, so my older cousin actually is a professional chef, so I got to watch him go to culinary school and have the kitchen experience and live a little bit vicariously through him. But no, a lot of what I've picked up about food and flavor and combinations comes from my family. My parents always growing up were incredible cooks and were so adventurous with the different flavors and profiles and the different kinds of cuisines that they tried to make food from. And being Ukrainian, we made everything from scratch, like everything from pickles to smoking our own fish to, making farmer's cheese and all sorts of things. So I had this really incredible culinary education just sort of through osmosis through them.
It made me really hungry actually reading the book. Were you cooking the recipes as you were writing them?
So the recipes and aftertaste, I think, fall into one of two categories. One category is there's something that I've tried before that I'm either riffing on or reinterpreting or borrowing inspiration from in order to craft the recipes and aftertaste. And again, I'll kind of alter different ingredients to make sure that I speak to the connection between the two characters that I'm trying to tether to one another through the food. So that's kind of one category, like something I've tasted before. And then there's another category of like, I completely invented this and who knows what this would be. And for that category, so for instance, the potato soup dish with the buffalo chowder, that was completely invented just based on things that I thought would go well together and would fit. So there were foods in here that I never actually tried and never actually replicated cooking. But then a few months ago, my US publisher hosted a dinner where we had a chef actually make some of the dishes from the book. It was unbelievable getting to taste some of these foods that had lived only in my head, reinterpreted by someone else in another form of artistry. It was such an incredible experience. And I will say it would make a very good cookbook because everything was really delicious.
Did you have a favorite meal from it?
So, Frankie's cake. Like, I still dream about that bite of cake. It was unreal. It was like perfectly balanced, salty and sweet. It was doused with rum and whiskey and scotch, and it was just really, really good. It was perfect.
That sounds divine. How much do you, how much of yourself do you see in the character of Constantine, and in what ways are you guys different?
So I think a lot of my upbringing and my background certainly informed Constantine. So like me, his family emigrated from Ukraine to the US when he was a kid, and he grew up in this situation where food was both this like really comforting thing and this very othering thing for him. So food was a way that he connected with his father, with Ukraine, where he couldn't be anymore, with his homeland. But it was also this way that he failed to connect with the kids around him and the people in his immediate community. Because I think it's a really common experience as an immigrant, especially as an immigrant kid, which I think, gets made into a trope, but I think is actually deeply painful, being at the cafeteria table and looking around, and you have this dish that you're really excited to eat at home when your parents are making it or you're there with your siblings. And then in the context of all the kids at your school, you feel like you're eating the wrong thing. In my case, everyone had peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the United States, and I would show up with like a Tupperware of something that at home I would be delighted to eat, and I was just mortified eating it. And I would beg my parents for prepackaged things. Like, we had something called Lunchables, where it had, these like tiny cutouts of cheese and cubes of turkey, and it was not great, but it was very acceptable because everyone had them. And so that's what I would beg my parents to get me because I just wanted to fit in and be normal. So I think Constantine certainly has all of those experiences. And I think it was really important to me to make him communicate that and bring that truth to life. But in other ways, I think we're completely different. I would have gotten much more curious about the experience of aftertastes than I think Constantine did. So in the book, he has these experiences as a child. He's about 10 years old when his father passes, and he's 11 the first time that he tastes one of these ghost flavors. And he immediately kind of recognizes what it is. But then, without any spoilers, he kind of shuts down about it. He doesn't want to engage with it. He gets scared off until he's in his 30s. I think that even if I were nervous about how it would be interpreted out in the real world, like privately, I would explore it probably and try to figure out what's happening with me. Like, how can I use this connection? What is this? So I think that's a major difference between us. And I think that my view of the world is probably a little more positive than Constantine's is at the start of the book. By the end, I think we wind up in a similar place. But yeah.
Constantine and the people who come to see him are all yearning for one last message or connection from a lost loved one. Grief is something that everyone experiences in some way at some time. How does writing about it help you to make sense of it, both personally and in a way that connects with others?
So I spent a lot of time thinking about how to talk about grief in this book, because there are so many different ways to grieve, and everyone experiences it in a drastically different way, in a different method, and what feels right to them, what feels satisfying to them. And I started to think about how do I communicate that through the different characters that I'm having Constantine interact with, and how do I also communicate that through Constantine and Mora, who's another main character, and Frankie, who's another main character, all of whom deal with grief in various ways throughout the book. They've all lost people, and in Kasia and Mora's case, they aren't able to move on from the losses that they experience, and they each have incredibly unhealthy ways of dealing with that grief, or not dealing with it in some cases. So I thought a lot about how do I represent both people who can't move on, who haven't been able to kind of move forward through their grief and kind of bring it with them into their lives, but still see that there's beauty and joy that they can still have in life. And how do I contrast that with characters who maybe have been able to do more of that? And how do I show it from the perspective of the spirit world, which we'll never, as living people, have access to? And how do I kind of communicate all of those different facets of this incredibly complex experience? So I thought a lot about the different cycles of grief, the Kubler-Ross cycle, traditional denial, anger, bargaining, depression. And what I found to be really interesting was recently, David Kessler, who was the co-author of that big theorem with Kubler-Ross, he published kind of a follow-up book where he said, I don't think acceptance is necessarily the last, stage of grief. He goes down to saying, I think it's more about finding meaning. And so I had that in mind a lot as well as I wrote the book. How do each of these characters end in a place where they find meaning in what they can do, and how they're using their gifts or their talents, or the closure that they found? How do they find meaning out of that? So that was something that I thought about a lot. And I think also, when I thought about the afterlife in this particular interpretation, I think that death is a very scary concept because it's so amorphous and there's so many unknowns. And I think for me, part of the exercise of writing this book was making it less scary for myself and for other people to think about it in this kind of joyful, beautiful, food-centric way.
Yeah, the two main characters, they also have a lot of guilt, don't they? That's what they really wrestle with. So I guess it's sort of forgiving yourself to be able to that acceptance as well as, the ultimate acceptance of grief.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, there's so many facets of emotion that people can experience around grief. Is it a reflection of you? Is it a reflection of the person that you lost? Is it a reflection of that relationship? Is it the things you never got to say that you thought you had more time to say? Is it something you said that you deeply regret because that was your last interaction? I think I tried to show as many of those different permutations as I could.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor in the book as well. How do you decide when and how to use it, especially in those more emotional or serious moments?
So one of the things that I knew right away, as soon as I set out to write this book, as soon as I had that little vision of the chef in the Hell's Kitchen apartment, was that I don't want this to be a scary book about ghosts, and I don't want this to be a sad book about death. So I wanted to make sure that everything felt very balanced. So there were as many kind of funny, high energy, thrillery, exciting, joyful moments in the book as there were more poignant, reflective moments. I knew that there had to be both, obviously, given the subject matter, but I didn't want the story to kind of feel one note and like we were only in one emotional state the whole time. And so there is a sweeping love story that encompasses the whole thing. There's a deep friendship that often adds moments of levity and humor. And one thing that I tried really consciously to do was structure the book in such a way where every scene that was a little bit more, reflective was balanced by scenes around it that had high energy. So if we had a moment where we had, a reunion between a spirit and a living person and it was very poignant, the next scene was going to be a party scene, or the next scene was going to be a really high energy, like kitchen throwdown type scene. So that as you read, you don't feel like you're constantly, in one sort of mental space. And I think that's also a really accurate reflection of grief because you can be grieving and then you can still laugh. There are still moments that are going to take you out of that, and then moments that are going to remind you of the person you lost and are going to feel, sharper. And one of the interesting things was I tried to structure the book like a cake. So there's five parts, and every part that has every chapter that has Constantine is sort of like the cake, the spongy part of the cake. It's told in third person, close to him. And then in between that are these sort of very short interstitial chapters, 2 to 3 pages, told from different characters' points of view. And those are kind of like the filling in between. And so every layer of the cake has a different filling, a different personality. And they're always intended to balance. So in the parts where Constantine is having a harder time, the filling character is always really upbeat and fun, and it's the food tour. In the moments where things turn around for him and he's falling in love and he's opening a restaurant, he's having a great time, the characters in those in-between moments are showing us things from the afterlife that give us more knowledge about what's happening that he may not have. So I tried to consciously structure it that way too.
Oh, that's interesting. A bit like food, isn't it? How you get the sweet and the salty and the umami. Do they say that? Yeah. Yeah.
Umami,
I thought that was really clever. And I think me and Mary, we had a conversation yesterday about it when we just said we can just see it as a film, the way that
yep.
it was written, and how like, I can just picture that guy taking that group on the food tour and describing all of the different places, and then it having a flashback to Constantine and how he got to where he got. So, yeah, I mean, somebody needs to buy this as a film.
It's been acquired, so fingers crossed it'll get made into a movie.
Oh, amazing. Fingers crossed, then we'll keep our eyes out for that. Oh, that's brilliant. And then what, now that it's published, what does a typical day look like for you at the minute?
So a typical day right now is a lot of promotion for the book, which is really exciting. It's been such a joy to get to talk about this book and this story and this narrative, with the readers and with podcasts and with you. But when I'm not kind of doing promotion for Aftertaste, I'm working on some other things. I'm working on a next book. I'm trying to do sort of thinking about future books. I tend to be a writer that works. I have sort of multiple pots on the burner. And depending on what I'm working on, I might rotate, or if I get bored with one thing, I'll work a little bit on something else. So I'm working on a primary project right now and like percolating three or four other ideas.
I love how even you just describing then, like what you're up to, you even use the food analogy there, like all the pots on the
I can't help it. I only talk in food metaphors now after this book.
I think it's brilliant. It just makes me hungry the whole time. And I know you kind of given us a little bit of a sneak peek there, but have you got any information that you can give us on what it is that you're working on next, what the next book's going to be about?
Sure, so it's still very early, so anything could kind of change, but it's also a speculative fiction novel. That is what you can always come to expect from me. So something that takes place in the real world but has an element of magic. In this case, it takes place in San Francisco. It starts at the turn of the century, so 1899. And it's a little bit more historically themed. It is about a woman who falls in love with a sailor on an enchanted ship, and they have to wait an extremely long time to be able to be together due to the confines of this enchantment. It's sort of about love. How can love survive over time? How can love evolve and change as the world changes around you?
Oh, wow. Sounds amazing.
Thank
And I'd love to
you.
know what sort of books you read. Could you give us a book recommendation?
So recently I picked up V.E. Schwab's new book, Bury Our Bones in the Midnight Soil, which I am loving. I am a big fan of her work, and I think that she dives so deeply into the psychology of her characters, and she really creates this rich lived-in world. So I'm really excited to be reading that. I'm also really looking forward to House of Beth by Carrie Cullen, which is kind of like a more gothic take on a slightly horror novel about a woman and a family that she works with and lives with. So I'm excited about both of those.
Oh, they sound amazing. We've got an endless list of books that to recommend.
It's been a very good year for books this year, so it's hard to even choose just one.
Yeah. And then there's the backlog from all the past years that I haven't got around to.
Oh, yes.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Daria. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for joining us on the Write Club.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Yeah, it's been brilliant to have you on. Thanks so much. And if anybody wants to go and purchase your The book Aftertaste, I mean, all of us would highly recommend it. So go and grab your copy.
Thank you so much. Enjoy.
Thanks for tuning into The Write Club. We hope you enjoyed this episode and feel inspired to keep writing. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at Writers Online, your go-to for writing tips, competitions, and exclusive updates. Plus, you'll never miss an episode of The Write Club. Until next time, happy writing!